Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, May 25th, 2023. Mother of slain Marfa ISD teacher awarded $7 million in damages by Allegra Hobbs, A-L-L-E-G-R-A at BigBendSentinel.com. Odessa. Theresa Blaine, the mother of slain Marfa ISD teacher Sophia Sullivan, has been awarded $7 million in damages to be paid by her daughter's alleged killer. The final judgment in a wrongful death suit filed by Blaine 3 years ago. The 2019 murder trial of Sophia Sullivan, which saw husband Daniel Sullivan accused of her stabbing death in Fort Davis, ended in a hung jury and has never been retried, with District Attorney Ori White blaming a backlog of cases stemming from pandemic-related delays. Daniel Sullivan, in the meantime, was released on bond and has been living in Illinois. But after the mistrial, Blaine decided to pursue justice through the civil courts. She filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Daniel in 2020, arguing that he had intentionally caused the death of her daughter. In March of this year, an Ector County court ruled in her favor, stating that Daniel Sullivan had caused Sophia's death and is liable under the Texas Wrongful Death Act. A bench trial date to determine the damages was set for May 4th. Daniel, who is representing himself, failed to appear altogether. The court ruled on May 9th that Daniel owes Blaine $7 million in damages to compound annually at an interest rate of 5%, plus attorney's fees and expenses, to the tune of $19,019.12. If Daniel appeals the court's ruling and is unsuccessful, he must pay Blaine for those legal expenses as well. The shocking 2018 killing yielded a heated 2-week trial that ended inconclusively. The prosecution leaned on the testimony of the Sullivan's young son, the sole witness of the murder, who identified his father as the killer to authorities, to a neighbor, and on the witness stand. The team also presented testimonies from neighbors, friends, and law enforcement, and extensive text message records revealing marital tension. The defense, however, argued that authorities had improperly questioned the child. Ultimately, jurors remained deadlocked after 17 hours of deliberation, and Judge Roy Ferguson declared a mistrial. In her 2020 complaint to the 161st District Court, Blaine made the case that Daniel Sullivan was responsible for her daughter's death. At the time of the murder, the complaint stated, divorce was imminent, and Sophia was researching legal avenues for gaining sole custody of her son and moving into teacher housing in Marfa. If Sophia had divorced Daniel, per the complaint, Daniel would have been removed as the beneficiary of her $150,000 life insurance policy, which he attempted to collect on the day of his arrest. Blaine's counsel had sought at least $1 million in damages, citing mental anguish, loss of consortium, grief, bereavement, loss of advice, care, and counsel, loss of society and companionship, and medical expenses. The suit languished until the beginning of 2023, when Blaine hired new counsel, which served Daniel Sullivan with a series of questions and requests for admissions, among them requests that Daniel admit he had intentionally killed his wife. Admit that the reason that you intentionally killed Sophia Sullivan was because she had decided to divorce you, the document reads. Daniel was given 30 days to respond, per the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, with Blaine's attorneys stating that the statements would be deemed admitted unless a response received within that time frame laid out in detail the reason why it cannot be truthfully admitted or denied. When Daniel did not respond, Blaine's counsel filed a motion for partial summary judgment, which the court granted, ruling that Daniel Sullivan had intentionally caused the death of Sophia Sullivan. The order that Daniel pay Blaine $7 million in damages plus attorney fees is the court's final judgment in the case, though Daniel has the option of appealing the ruling. Neither Daniel Sullivan nor Blaine's attorney, John Sopuch, returned requests for comment by press time. Bill allowing Jeff Davis County to apply for municipal grants headed to Governor's Desk. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Jeff Davis County, HB 1330, a bill that allows for unincorporated communities in Jeff Davis County to apply for grants typically reserved for municipalities, recently passed both the House and the Senate. The legislation now heads to Governor Greg Abbott, who local officials expect to sign it into law effective September 1st. Last week, the Big Bend Sentinel caught up with Judge Curtis Evans as he was driving back to Fort Davis from Austin, where he testified on the bill's behalf to the Senate Local Government Committee at the Capitol. After meeting with Senator Cesar Blanco and other legislators, Evans was hopeful the bill would soon make it past the Senate and to the governor's desk to be signed into law, a move which would allow rural Jeff Davis County to apply for more state and federal funding relating to infrastructure projects and more. Upon hearing the news this week that the bill passed the Senate, county employees were already looking into funding opportunities, said Evans. We are elated and ready to move forward. We are beginning searching for grants right now in order to put it to use for Jeff Davis County, said Evans. There's no guarantee that we'll get anything, but it just affords us the opportunity to apply for more funding, he added. The bill, sponsored by Blanco and Representative Eddie Morales, will specifically allow Jeff Davis County Commissioner's Court to pursue grants on behalf of its unincorporated communities, such as Fort Davis, for public improvement projects, including sidewalks, streets, roads, water, wastewater and drainage, as well as more general initiatives including advertising, promotion, health and sanitation, public safety, security, business recruitment, development, recreation, and cultural enhancement. Evans said the passage of the bill, which previous County Commissioner Todd Jagger originally pursued 2 years ago during the 87th legislative session, will open up an array of funding opportunities, and while there were no specific priorities set, county commissioners would begin to assess options as soon as possible. We will just have to find out what all else is available that hasn't been in the past, said Evans. It may help us with our police, our fire, our EMS, parks. In a statement to the Big Bend Sentinel, Representative Morales said the new program should help local government officials further invest in the county's infrastructure, in turn positively impacting area residents. For decades, our communities out in West Texas have been left behind and not provided adequate access to state funds for maintaining infrastructure projects, especially our unincorporated communities, said Morales. The bill is specifically written for Jeff Davis County and does not include Ozona, for example, another unincorporated West Texas town located in nearby Crockett County. Evans said Fort Davis has chosen to remain unincorporated rather than become a municipality to avoid city taxes in addition to county taxes. As it stands, the County Commissioner's Court effectively runs the area, he said, without additional city roles, such as a mayor or city council. We don't need to create more taxes in order for that extra layer of government. The county is already handling it, said Evans. Our taxes are maybe a little higher, but you don't have that second layer of taxes. Valentine, however, is an official city located within Jeff Davis County, which means the county is restricted from spending its funds within city limits, and Valentine is on their own relating to infrastructure projects. The county works with a handful of grant writers, including GrantWorks, as well as locals Sandra Chambers, the judge's executive assistant, Peggy Fonseca, the EMS chief, and Aaron Ray, the Jeff Davis County Library Director, who will assist with new grant funding initiatives. Evans, who traveled overnight to Austin to address state leaders at the early morning hearing on the bill and made the journey a previous time to address the House, said he believed his in-person appearances were more meaningful than if he had appeared virtually, and it was worth the extra effort to see HB 1330 adopted into law. "I want to be able to shake their hand and thank them for their hard work and their support of rural communities," said Evans. "The connections I made today in the Senate, you can't make those connections virtually. It's more personable, and I think it's way more official." Photo courtesy of Judge Evans. Senator Cesar Blanco and County Judge Curtis Evans, after testifying at the state capitol in favor of HB 1330, a bill that opens up grant funding opportunities for Jeff Davis County's unincorporated communities. P.J. Serrano ordered held without bond by Allegra Hobbs, A-L-L-E-G-R-A, at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. A judge has ordered Marfa resident Patricio Javier P.J. Serrano held without bail after being charged with possession of child pornography. Serrano, 35, was apprehended May 5th by the FBI and Texas DPS after a search of his phone revealed images and videos of child pornography involving prepubescent boys, according to a criminal complaint. He was formally arrested on May 11th and charged on May 12th. He has been detained since then, first at the Presidio County Jail before being transferred to a facility in Sierra Blanca. On Friday, U.S. Magistrate Judge David B. Fannin ordered Serrano held without bond pending trial, citing clear and convincing evidence that the defendant poses a danger to the community and is a flight risk. The judge's order also cites Serrano's criminal record prior to this arrest, noting he faces pending harassment charges. In April, he was arrested by the Marfa Police Department for harassment, then again days later for violating a protective order. Serrano has yet to be indicted. His defense attorney, Shane O'Neill, said he was still awaiting the outcome of the discovery process and the judgment of a grand jury, anticipated next month, which will determine exactly what charges his client faces. "I'm curious to see exactly what charges the grand jury is going to come back with and whether the discovery is going to support this, and am waiting to determine what our defense is going to look like based on that," said O'Neill. Serrano coached a softball team for girls 10 and up with the Big Bend Amateur Softball Association, BBASU. After his arrest, BBASU representative Letty Carrillo stated on the league's Facebook page that the news was a shock, that Serrano had been suspended, and that at this time there are no allegations that involve any of the Lady Horns' 10U players. Revived wilderness designation efforts for Big Bend National Park continue with public meetings. By Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Big Bend National Park. Keep Big Bend Wild, a nonprofit consisting of conservationists and retired park employees, is reviving a decades-old advocacy campaign for the passage of a Congressional Wilderness Designation Act the group argues is integral in protecting Big Bend National Park from future overdevelopment. The potential Big Bend National Park Wilderness Act will not formally appear before legislators until at least 2 years from now, and proponents are currently soliciting feedback from the public about the wilderness designation. An additional federal protection for national parks that would limit development within certain boundaries. This is about protecting the things that people tell us time and time again that they love about Big Bend National Park, explained Superintendent Bob Krumenacher to a group of around 20 individuals at a public meeting in Alpine last week. The wide open spaces, the dark skies, the wildlife, and so many other natural values of the park. The official wilderness designation from the federal government, which 50 out of 65 U.S. national parks, including Texas Guadalupe Mountains, hold, was originally proposed for Big Bend back in 1978, but was never formally signed into law. The initiative dates back to the 1964 Wilderness Act, which established the Wilderness Preservation System to ensure public lands were preserved for the enjoyment of future generations. Joining Keep Big Bend Wild in the effort, which would see two-thirds of Big Bend National Park's 800,000-plus acres designated as wilderness, are current park leaders, as well as the Big Bend Conservancy, the park's Friends Group. All were present for Alpine and Terlingua-based meetings last week, in which draft legislation, preliminary maps, and fact sheets were shared with attendees. The solicitation of public feedback is part of the ongoing bill proposal process, and Congressman Tony Gonzalez has yet to take a position on the matter. In Alpine, after brief presentations from supporters, still some attendees found the concept of the wilderness designation slippery. Why was it needed in an already protected area? What would it change? And why wouldn't people be in support? Do I get this right, that we're discussing how much of a wilderness is? Asked Alpine resident Dallas Baxter. What I can't understand is why we're all not standing up and applauding, because there's going to be this honest-to-God wilderness area. I don't understand why you wouldn't want that. Krumenacher explained that with park popularity reaching all-time highs, achieving the highest standard for protection of the public lands, and assuring more rigid oversight of ever-changing park employees would help preserve what is so special about the park in the first place. We've heard from a lot of people about killing the golden goose. If there's too much development, some people believe, then we're going to lose the night sky, we're going to lose the quiet, we're going to lose the wildlife habitat, said Krumenacher. The park has, by and large, already been managing the proposed wilderness areas as wilderness, with sensitivity to the natural environment and visitor experience, proponents explained. This act of Congress would, in essence, limit existing developments to current footprints. Preliminary maps show buffer zones around all existing roads and visitor sites, including the Chisos Basin, leaving room for some adjacent expansion and necessary road maintenance. The goal would be to keep any future development to the areas that are already developed, so doing infill and growing right next to them, as opposed to bisecting the big open spaces with something that does not exist, said Krumenacher. Current visitor facilities and roads will exist in perpetuity, while any additional developments inside of the wilderness area would be limited to mostly trails and campsites. Mechanized equipment is forbidden in wilderness areas, meaning that horses and mules would be permitted modes of transport, while cars and mountain bikes would not. There are, however, provisions for vehicles and aircrafts required for any emergency medical services, border patrol, or wildfire incidents. The Rio Grande River is excluded from the wilderness designation. Raymond Skiles, retired park wildlife biologist and wilderness coordinator and member of Keep Big Bend Wild, said public feedback is still informing the maps, buffer zones, and more. The group is working from the original wilderness map proposed back in 1978, but is making tweaks, such as standardizing buffer zones around roads to 100 feet on either side of the highway, and taking out a measure that would have closed Black Gap Road, a popular remote four-wheel driving route. Even though the 78 map had that happen, we don't want to get into this business of reducing traditional activities, said Skiles. The potential new wilderness designation would still allow for scientific studies relating to plants, animals, and cultural resources activities, such as archaeological digs, to occur. There's the old 1882 cavalry camp out in Neville Springs. It's in the wilderness, but if somebody wants to study it, or even if there's things that need restoration that are properly identified historic structures, all that's fine, said Skiles. Some citizens have expressed concerns about the movement, namely with regards to potential impacts on the county's burgeoning tourism. Proponents have heard the fear that the wilderness designation will attract even more tourists to the area. Skiles didn't deny this was a possibility, but didn't foresee a significant increase of already high visitors' numbers. Historically, fears of losing visitors, among other concerns, have stalled the proposed designation. As reported by Marfa Public Radio, state and local officials in the 1970s opposed what they saw as an effort by the federal government to decrease accessibility, thereby discouraging tourism. More recently, Starlight Theater owner and Brewster County Tourism Council Board President Bill Ivey, who was present for meetings on the matter back in the 70s, has declined to endorse the plan. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Ivey said he was eager to see a more formal proposal on the idea and was still very leery of the wilderness designation. He said he ultimately didn't understand the need to restrict development when current infrastructure was struggling to keep up with demand. I don't see a need for it. I mean, the bottom line is, Big Bend has reached a point that it needs more parking. It's beyond its capacity already, said Ivey. The question of how to collectively manage growth in the general area, where nearby Terlingua has ballooned with short-term rentals, in part to meet the needs of more tourists flocking to the national park, would be an ongoing discussion, said Skiles, but there was an immediate need to ensure the gem of the area, the national park, was safeguarded. We need to recognize these wide-open, undeveloped spaces for being the true value of Big Bend, the reason people like it, the reason they come here, said Skiles. We're going to say by this act that we treasure and intend to preserve the wide-open space. Within the park, there are ongoing projects, totaling around $75 million, to improve existing infrastructure, said Krumenacker, including repaving of roads, replacement of underground water pipes, and renovations to the Chisos Mountains Lodge. And the park, like the surrounding communities, has limited resources to support visitors, he said. Water is scarce, and the park's landfill is approaching its capacity. Moving forward, Keep Big Bend Wild intends to refine build language and maps with public input and address the concerns of the few critics that have weighed in. This is not at all a done deal. All our documents are not in final form in Congress's hands. We certainly hope to have continued dialogue, said Skiles. Among the Big Bend National Park Wilderness Designation supporters are the Big Bend Chamber of Commerce, Commissioner Sarah Colando, the Alpine City Council, and Mayor Catherine Eves, a number of Native American tribes, river outfitters, and many more. Superintendent Krumenacker, who will retire from the role this summer, making way for a new top park administrator, said he has received feedback from visitors that would like to see the park continue to be managed as it is today, who wonder how they can make sure their grandkids have the same unspoiled natural experience with the Chihuahuan Desert that they did. What I'm saying, based on 41 years of experience in the National Park Service, is that the best way to provide the greatest certainty that our grandkids will have the same type of experience that we have today, without taking away any of the experiences that we do have, would be to see a bill like this passed, said Krumenacher. For more information, visit keepbigbendwild.org. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. Members of Keep Big Bend Wild, the National Park Service, Big Bend Conservancy, and more met with the public last week to discuss a potential wilderness designation for Big Bend.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, May 25th, 2023. Jury finds Woodward not guilty of murder. 5 days of testimony and 90 minutes of deliberation led to a not guilty verdict in the trial of Justin Farrell Woodward on May 9th. Numerous law enforcement officers, private citizens, forensic scientists, and crime scene analysts testified in the trial. A Pecos County jury of 10 men and 2 women found Woodward not guilty of the murder of his wife, Delilah, who died January 11, 2018, from a contact range gunshot wound to the head, according to the medical examiner. The jury also found Woodward not guilty of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon against a family member. However, the same jury found Woodward guilty of felon in possession of a firearm, a third-degree felony. Jury deliberations lasted approximately 1.5 hours after closing arguments. Woodward's case was indicted and tried in the 83rd Judicial District Court before the Honorable Robert E. Cadena. In 2021, 83rd District Attorney Ori White recused himself from handling Woodward's cases because he had previously represented Woodward, including a brief representation for the charges in this case. Judge Cardena appointed District Attorney Lori K. English as the 83rd District Attorney pro tem to prosecute the case. She was assisted in trial by Assistant DA Jerry Phillips. Woodward was represented by J.W. Johnson and Albert Valadez. Punishment testimony was scheduled to begin the next morning after the jury's verdict. Woodward had been indicted for multiple felony offenses committed in Pecos and Upton counties, all of which took place after the events of January 11, 2018, and one felony committed in Presidio County on October 14, 2017. After the jury's guilty verdict for the felon in possession of firearm, defense attorneys Valadez and Johnson and attorney pro tem Lori English negotiated the punishment of 8 years in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for the case that was tried. Additionally, plea bargains were negotiated to resolve the following outstanding felony indictments that were pending in Presidio, Upton, and Pecos counties. On October 14, 2017, Presidio County, Woodward committed the offense of endangering a child. Woodward pleaded guilty to the charge and was sentenced to 2 years in the Department of Criminal Justice, which is the maximum sentence. On January 27, 2021, in Upton County, Woodward committed the offense of deadly conduct. He pleaded guilty to the charge and was sentenced to 5 years in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. On January 27, 2021, in Pecos County, Woodward committed the offense of felon in possession of firearm. He pleaded guilty to the charge and was sentenced to 5 years in the Department of Criminal Justice. On July 30, 2022, in Pecos County, he committed the offenses of assault against peace officer, 2 counts, which involved an altercation with and injury to 2 local game wardens. Woodward pleaded guilty to the charge and was sentenced to 8 years. Cases involving domestic violence are challenging for everyone involved in the criminal justice system, from investigations by law enforcement officers through jury verdicts. These cases encompass many difficult relationship dynamics and pose many challenges for everyone involved. Seeking justice on behalf of the citizens of Pecos County is an honor, and my office is committed to this pursuit and to the safety of our communities, said English. Friends of the Pecos River to sponsor STEM Lab. The Sol Ross State University La Frontera Research Institute for STEM Mobile Lab is headed for the Alley-Oop Festival in Ira Ann, June 2nd, 3rd. The Friends of the Pecos River, a nonprofit organization dedicated to river stewardship, is sponsoring the lab at the event. Alley-Oop, named for the comic strip created by Iran by V.T. Hamlin while he was living and working as a map maker in the oil fields, was resurrected a couple of years ago after a decade-long hiatus. The festival promises a parade, pageant, tournament, dancing, fireworks, vendors, and more. The Mobile STEM Lab delivers educational, hands-on, entertaining activities directly to students. The lab is the result of a collaboration between Sol Ross Noyes scholars in La Frontera program and the Science Mill Museum in Johnson City. All components of the lab fit neatly in the van and allow for a few people to quickly set up the displays, most of which remain on carts that are wheeled into the van on its built-in ramp and are then strapped into place. The mobile program benefits future STEM teachers and others by introducing future careers and digital literacies to educators, parents, college students, K-12 students, and the public. The Friends of the Pecos River was formed in 2020 with a primary focus in Texas from Imperial to Sheffield. According to FPR, this section suffers from long-term proximity to the oil patch, regional groundwater depletion, and persistent drought. The river's health has consequences for people and wildlife around it and the waters downstream. Their mission is to enhance water quality and quantity in this piece of the Pecos River through community engagement, educational programs, landowner outreach, collaborative research, and restoration projects on public and private lands. For more information or to book the mobile lab, email noyce@solross.edu. For more information about Alley-Oop, call 302-1429 or 302-1317. For more information about FPR, email info@friendsofthepecosriver.org. The Center for Land Stewardship and Stakeholder Engagement at Borderlands Research Institute at Sol Ross State University has streamlined its application process for cost-share conservation programs. Cost-share programs reimburse a percentage of the overall cost of qualified conservation practices to selected landowners. Interested landowners can now apply through one convenient portal that will remain open year-round. Applicants will be considered for any open programs. We are pleased to make it easier for West Texas landowners to access funds that will help them implement conservation practices across the Trans-Pecos, said Billy Tarrant, who is Associate Director of Stewardship Services at BRI. Thanks to our many partners, conservation-minded landowners are getting the financial help they need to improve wildlife habitat that benefits us all. One program currently available, the Greater Big Bend Conservation Partnership Program, will reimburse approximately 50% of project costs. The program is available to eligible landowners in Brewster, Jeff Davis, and Presidio counties. The effort is fueled by a $3.5 million commitment from the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service Regional Conservation Partnership Program, which will help fund innovative conservation approaches on private lands, including habitat restoration efforts, conservation easements, and ecosystem services. Eligible habitat management activities include, but are not limited to, grassland restoration via brush management, riparian restoration, and construction of wildlife-friendly fencing. The Greater Big Bend Conservation Partnership is managed by the Center for Land Stewardship and Stakeholder Engagement, which is responsible for implementing restoration and enhancement projects, as well as monitoring and evaluating projects. The center is working in partnership with the Texas Agricultural Land Trust, which will provide the expertise for all conservation easements, as well as evaluation of ecosystem services and assessing ecosystem services compensation options. Other cost-share programs include the Partners for Habitat program, a collaborative initiative with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. This program will provide $150,000 of financial assistance directly to private landowners across the West Texas counties of Brewster, Terrell, Pecos, Reeves, Culberson, Huspeth, and Jeff Davis and Presidio. projects that will be funded include habitat enhancement and restoration actions that may include but are not limited to the following practices: brush management, mechanical and chemical, invasive species removal treatment, establishment of native vegetation, pollinator plantings, streamside management, and erosion control practices. To learn more about cost share programs and to apply, visit the Borderlands Research Institute website at bri.solross.edu/stewardship. County hires new employee at Extension Office by Sean Yorks. With the impending retirement of Pecos County Extension Agent Karen Helfelfinger, the Texas AgriLife Extension Office is welcoming a new addition to the staff. Commissioner's Court approved the hiring of Elaine Habe at its May 22nd meeting. Habe will be the Extension Agent for Agriculture and Natural Resources and will begin June 1. She grew up in Medina County in a farming and ranching family and was heavily involved in 4-H and FFA. She has a certificate in veterinary medicine from the University of Florida, a Bachelor of Science degree in animal science, pre-vet, from Texas A&M Kingsville, and has experience in veterinary medicine. After I graduated from Kingsville, I was planning on vet school, but that is not an option anymore. I wanted to continue my education so I wouldn't hurt my rhythm of learning and did the year-long program with Florida Online in forensic science. Most veterinarians do that after they get their vet degrees. I decided to jump the gun and get it beforehand. She said she's looking forward to working in Pecos County and has already met some of the Pecos 4-H kids and their parents. We scheduled our leadership advisory board meeting for June 12th so she can get trained with the leadership team and meet those individuals. So that will be a smooth transition for her coming into this job and being supportive of the families in the community activities. Helfelfinger will retire after 17 years in Pecos County, effective June 30, and a replacement will take over in the fall. The job will be posted after June 30th, and the next hiring date will be September 1. I thank the court and the commissioners and all of you for your support during these years and what you have done to highlight and help make the 4-H Extension grow in this county. Your guide to local places to go and things to do. The Summer Off the Patio Concert Series at Annie Riggs Museum begins on Thursday, May 25th with Donovan Keith playing from 7:30 to 9. The event is free to the public and presented by the Fort Stockton Historical Society. Texas A&M Extension 4-H Gift Card Bingo at 6 p.m. on May the 30th in the large community hall at Rooney Park, supporting West of the Pecos 4-H. Call 336-2541 for more information. A Memorial Day service will take place at 10 a.m. on May 31st at Zero Stone Park. The public is invited. Fort Stockton Public Library's Summer Reading Program kicks off June 1st with Bronson Chadwick, Artist of the Impossible, at 6 p.m. at the library. Sign-ups for the summer reading program are underway now. The Fort Stockton Film Society presents The Searchers at 7 p.m. at the Nelson Street Theater on June the 3rd. Admission is free. On June the 16th, the Summer Off the Patio Concert Series at Annie Riggs Museum with Wayne West playing from 7:30 to 9 p.m. The event is free to the public and presented by the Fort Stockton Historical Society. FSCT Community Theater Camp. The Fort Stockton Community Theater announces its fourth annual Be Cool, Stay Cool Summer Theater Camp for incoming 1st through 6th graders. The camp will be held at the Nelson Street Theater Monday through Friday, June 19th to 30th, from 1 to 3 p.m. each afternoon. The charge is $20 per child. There is a discount for multiple children in a family. Alice Dirksen will be in charge of the camp, where students will learn theater terminology, stage skills, cooperation, and working together for a common goal. A Fractured Fairy Tale will be performed with free admission on Friday, June 30th, for family and friends. There must be at least 10 students registered for the camp by noon on Thursday, June 15th, in order for the camp to be offered. Call Alice Dirksen at 336-3180 for more information or to register. School Board Hears Insurance Claims Update by Sean Yorks. The effects of the October 10th hailstorm that pummeled Fort Stockton are still visible today, including on each campus of the Independent School District. The Board of Trustees on May 22nd heard an update from King adjusting on the state of those claims, and the news was not good. James King is public adjuster for the district, and he's provided us with a timeline in regards to the hailstorm that took place in October and the issues that we have with the insurance companies, said Superintendent Zamora. Zamora said the insurance company was wanting to really lowball us. King said all the buildings in the district were damaged by the storm, adding that the engineer from the insurance company who inspected the buildings last November was an engineer in training. They missed a lot of damage. They basically said there was little to no damage. The district hired King to inspect the buildings, and he came to a different conclusion. There's a lot of hail damage to all the roofs. Also, you've got damage to the exterior walls, the HVAC, that are on the roofs. They all look like somebody took a baseball bat to all of them. King compiled detailed reports and met with the insurance company's engineer and representatives in February and met with another representative in March. The insurance company agreed that there was a massive amount of hail damage to the buildings. We had a verbal agreement on it, but then when we actually got the reports that came back from the insurance company, they've actually backtracked that. The report says that they paid too much money back in January. They're saying there's little to no damage. Board Vice President Anastasio Dominguez asked if the insurance company was claiming pre-existing damage. King said that they're not when it comes to the roof damage, but are saying that they have no idea when the damage to the HVAC units took place. I reviewed all the previous claims, and there wasn't any hail damage documented on the HVAC units for previous claims, so there's no basis for that. The board retired to executive session to discuss possible action regarding the claims, and after about a 45-minute executive session, reconvened and determined to retain legal counsel pursuant to Chapter 2254 of the Government Code to handle litigation process and procedures regarding damage caused by the October 10th storm. In prior action, board members Kay Griffith and Jennifer Gonzalez were sworn in as new trustees. Florentino Garcia was voted board president. Anastasio Domingo was elected vice president. Ursula Sanchez, secretary, and Freddie Martinez, assistant secretary.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, May 18th. Council certifies liquor election. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Council members met on Tuesday for their regularly scheduled meeting, and after establishing a quorum, members canvassed the May 6th special election results. Mayor Adam Steen read the election results aloud to the council and certified the local option election to allow for the sale of alcoholic beverages, including mixed beverages, throughout Monahans, as passed as well as all 7 of the amendments to the Code of Ordinances. Afterwards, the council declared the results. The council then certified the unopposed mayor-at-large, District 2 and 3 council seats, currently occupied by Jeppy Wilson and Calvin Carroll, respectively. Quote, since there is a 5-day waiting period after the votes are canvassed, the mayor and council members will be sworn in during the next council meeting on May 23rd, City Manager Rex Thee said. After canvassing votes, members then acted and approved the first and final readings of Ordinances 1310 and 1311, which declare results of the Charter Amendment propositions and legalize the sale of all alcoholic beverages, including mixed drinks. In other business, the Council considered approving previous minutes and a request from Monahans Community Church to close East 3rd Street between Allen and Bruce for a Father's Day celebration from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. on June 18th. Both items were approved, and the group convened into executive session to discuss personnel matters, Councilmember District 1 appointment. The seat is currently left unoccupied after the recent passing of longtime member Rudy Hernandez. After reconvening in open session, no action was taken. The City Council meets every second and fourth Tuesday of the month at 3 p.m. Anyone wanting to address the City Council on topics addressed in this story or any other topic may do so by asking to be added to the meeting agenda in the City Secretary's office located inside City Hall, or by appearing at the meeting during the public comment section of the meeting which is on every agenda. The Council will meet again on May 23rd in the Council Chambers of City Hall, located at 112 West 2nd Street at 3 p.m. The meeting is open to the public. MEDC considers making offer on Stockton property. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Meeting in regular session on Monday, the Monahans Economic Development Corporation, MEDC, board members decided to make an offer on a 1.1-acre property recently up for sale across the street from Lowe's Marketplace. Director Ashley Adalto told the board, quote, "The property, located at 1200 South Stockton, is currently listed for $630,000, which is considerably more than what the board paid for the HTO location, but due to the size comparison between the two, the price seems reasonable," end quote. After a brief discussion, the board agreed to look into the price of the HTO location property and then decided on a number to submit to the realtor. In other business, the board approved a contract with Amerigroup, the company selected to complete the revision of the flume in the East Monahan subdivision. The board approved a bid for flume revision during last month's meeting for a total of $75,000. Quote, "Justin Till looked over the contract and made a few changes, and the contract states any changes have to be approved by the board," Adalto said. In final actions, the board rejected a settlement offer from Cy Monahan's Brothers Hospitality, LLC, for Lot 1, Block 27, in the East Monahan subdivision. The group was originally supposed to build a Staybridge Hotel on the property. Quote, "The offer is for $750,000, which is twice as much as the property was sold for, and despite the contract states the buyback on the property is 80%, Adalto said. Member Hal Upchurch suggested rejecting the offer and said to send them a letter stating we will pay the buyback amount minus all attorney fees incurred to date. The board agreed to reject the offer and send them the letter. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable for the month of April totaling $36,400, which included $6,600 for payroll salaries, $1,100 to Maverick Engineering for the 12th Street Basin, and $5,800 to Aaron Rodriguez for broadband concrete slab, and $16,500 to Cotton Bledsoe Tie for the Basin Sidewalk Project. The financial report reflected a balance of $2.9 million in available funds, and minutes of the April 17th regular meeting were approved. Directors present were Richard Irwin, Hal Upchurch, Leticia Rodriguez, and Mary Elena Sines. Member Kathy Anthony was absent. Elizondo given probation for 2022 child sex crime charge. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. 143rd Judicial District Judge Mike Swanson handed down a deferred adjudication sentence on May 2nd for a felony sex act involving a child. Marcelino Antonio Primera Elizondo of 1408 South Fay Street waived his right to a jury trial and pled guilty to a charge of indecency with a child sexual contact, a second-degree felony. Ward County Sheriff's deputies arrested the 24-year-old Monahan's man on charges of indecency with a child after an outcry was made on January 24, 2022. According to court documents, a complainant came to the sheriff's office saying a female child, younger than 17, told authorities Elizondo touched her inappropriately around November 2021. Following protocol, A forensic interview with Harmony Home was conducted, and during the course of the investigation, deputies learned Elizondo did touch the female victim for his own sexual gratification, the report concluded. In the Texas Penal Code, indecency with a child by contact involves touching of the genitals, anus, or breast of a child with the intent to arouse or gratify any person's sexual desire, regardless of whether the touching is over or under the clothing. He was sentenced to 8 years deferred adjudication by Judge Swanson. Elizondo was also assessed a fine of $3,500 and court costs of $494. Deferred adjudication is a form of plea deal that enables a person to avoid a trial and possible conviction. The defendant can enter a plea of guilty or no contest to a charge in exchange for deferred adjudication, which means the judge doesn't find them guilty, but rather defers any finding of guilt in exchange for the acceptance of an alternative course of action. He will also be required to register as a sex offender. Attorneys for the state were Randall W. Reynolds and Alan Nicholas, assistant district attorney. Exchange students finish up year at MHS. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. Four Monahans Wicket Paiute High School seniors will be returning to their home countries after receiving their diplomas on May 26th. Nicholas Braz came to Monahans from São José dos Campos, Brazil. In Brazil, students pay a private company to help place them as exchange students and are given a choice of states, not towns. Quote, "My dad was an exchange student when he was in school, so he encouraged me to become an exchange student, and my mom cried because I would be gone for a year," Nicholas said. The credits earned during this year's education will count toward his own country's education requirements. Nicholas plans to work as an English teacher to earn the money needed to go to medical college to become a psychiatrist. Nicholas will be saying goodbye to his host parent, Jill Ramos, and returning home on May 28. Quote, "I have kept in close touch with my family during this past year, especially my girlfriend. I call her every day," Nicholas said. Enzo Pajorio is also from Brazil, the city of Sao Paulo. Enzo has enjoyed being involved in MHS sports during his year in Monahans. His parents were in favor of him being an exchange student, but, quote, "I cried the whole 10-hour flight, wondering if I was crazy for what I had done," Enzo said. He doesn't plan on college, but wants to play professional basketball in his country. Enzo's host parents have been Bill and Stephanie Clayton. Natalia Nunez came to MHS from A Coruña, Spain. Her credits earned here will count in her country, but she will have to take a test to be admitted to college. Natalia is not sure what kind of career she wants to study for, so she will take basic courses her first year in college. As a continuation of her dance training, Natalia has been active in ballet dancing at Out West Dance Academy while living with her host parents, Jonathan and Raina Lingman. She will continue her dance training when she gets back home. Quote, "When I was told where I was going in the exchange program, I tried to find Monahans on the map. I could not find it. I thought I was coming to a little tiny town of maybe 500 people," Natalia laughed. Natalia's parents were fine with her being an exchange student because her sister was an exchange student in Minnesota 2 years ago. Quote, "I have learned a lot about myself in this year and also found out I love baseball," Natalia said. She will be returning home on May 31st. Tom Heuer is from Wendeberg, Germany, and has had Jill Ramos as his host parent and Nicholas as his exchange brother. Tom will have to take his senior year all over again, as Germany does not accept the same school credits has earned in Texas. After retaking his final year of school, he does plan to go to college to become a software engineer. Quote, "I really had a great experience playing football. I even broke two bones," Tom smiled. He will be going home on June 1st. Rivera named honorary All-Star coach. The story was written by Armando Flores. Retired Monahan School head baseball coach Arcadio Rivera recently received an unexpected honor from the Texas High School Baseball Coaches Association, the THSBCA. The former skipper of the Lobos was named as an honorary coach for the 2023 THSBCA All-Star Game, which will be held Saturday, June 17th at Dell Diamond in Round Rock, the home of the Texas Rangers AAA Farm Club, the Round Rock Express. Rivera was in charge of the baseball program during two different stints. The first was in the late 1980s before going into administration for a time. The itch to coach never left him, and he returned in the late 90s and into the 2000s, where he led the Lobos to several lengthy playoff runs, which were the longest in the program's history. He will be one of several to be honored as honorary coach for the games. Rivera will be presented with a shirt and cap, along with a ring, for being honored that day. Joe Ray Halsey, a counterpart of Rivera, who coached at Andrews against Monahans, was the first to inform Rivera of the honor. Halsey currently serves as president of the Texas Alumni High School Baseball Coaches Association. Halsey said, quote, "Coach Rivera's teams were always well coached. They were smart and determined players. When you played Monahans, you had to be ready. His teams had a quiet confidence in their approach to the game. Coach was a player coach and a true all-star coach," end quote. Honorary coaches are selected by a committee of 5 members of the alumni group and coaching peers. Jeff Jones, who coached alongside Rivera for many years in Monahan, said, quote, "Coach Rivera, to me, was a mentor that I still try to emulate today. He is a man of integrity, hard work, and dedication, and always pushed the athletes to be the best that they could be, no matter what they did. He always encouraged his students to compete, and that was not only in athletics, but also in life," end quote. Congratulations to Coach Rivera on such an esteemed honor from his peers.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.